Welcome to The Good Stuff with Sonoma County Wine Growers. I'm Virginie Boone alongside Carissa Cruz, President CEO of The Wine Growers. We are here to talk about what makes Sonoma County such a special place to grow, make, and enjoy wine.
Yes, and I'm thankful for all of that.
And mildly distracted, maybe?
What?
I don't know.
You brought orange slices. It's hard to be focused.
Okay.
Those were like my dad's favorite.
Mm.
Yeah.
Kind of
like literally
a good
go-to
at all times.
I literally remember going to Christmas Eve church with my dad's mom, so my grandmother on my dad's side, in George, Iowa. And at the end of the church service on Christmas Eve, you'd get a little like sack with candy and like an apple and nuts in it. And there would always be orange slices.
Like candied orange slices.
Okay. Well, these.
Yeah. Okay.
Like
well,
these. You know, legitimate, I mean, like these. Mm-hmm. So I'm having like a nostalgia moment.
Was George, Iowa named after anybody in particular?
I have no idea. I mean, there were only like 500 residents, so most likely.
There's a lot of people here named George, so we're just going to name it that.
Completely. I mean, it was a very German, which was my dad's roots, little town. And a farming town, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so I'm thankful you brought orange slices because it reminds me of growing up.
So, anything else you're thankful for?
Well, so much. Why, thanks for asking. I'm thankful for our producer Jeff.
Okay. Producer Jeff. And
yes.
Yep,
and maybe
always.
We should just pause for a moment of thankfulness for producer Jeff.
We should. We
now
really
he's laughing.
Should.
Okay, he's smiling. We're in a good place today then. No, super excited all of November. If you've been following along with our foundation social media, we have been calling Gratitude Month and very much focused on elevating and talking about and showcasing our vineyard workforce. So every day there's either one of our employees of the year is being featured, members of our leadership academy, the different classes are being featured, folks that have won one of our employee of the month awards under the different categories. So I would follow along. It's some of our most shared social media posts because it's just really fun to get the background stories and amazingly surprising always, especially on Facebook, how many of our vineyard employees are on Facebook. And once they're tagged in something, it gets shared out to a very broad community. So
well, how nice for that.
I know. And it's also a time when we reach out to our community members and donors and thank them for their support and ask them for continued support to specifically continue our employee recognition program, our leadership academy, and continue to fund our resiliency program. So it's a great just time of reflection and appreciation.
And isn't it interesting that it's Gratitude Month in November?
And right during the month of Thanksgiving.
And at the very end, we have a gigantic feast where we, who knows what we'll have.
Thankful for the food.
Orange slices.
Which means they're thankful for the farmers and the employees who were out there creating, farming, the bounty we get to enjoy on Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
All the things.
The bounty.
The bounty.
Such a funny word.
I know. The cornucopia of delight.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Sorry. I know. I was my own AI this morning, so there you go. Chat KPT.
Cornucopia and bounty. And we will come back with a bountiful conversation with our guests on today's Good Stuff. Thank you for joining us on today's Good Stuff. In studio, we have Gaspar Hafner, second-generation winemaker, and Scott Hafner, managing partner at Hafner Vineyard. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so you're both second-generation, yeah?
We're both second-generation. Park's older.
Okay. That you had to make that clear.
It's already started.
Yeah, it's already started. Okay. So tell us about your childhood. No. I mean, we do want to know about your childhood, but I mean, you've both grew up at Hafner. Tell us a little bit about the history of Hafner, and then you both grew up there, yeah?
Well, we grew up in Berkeley, and our parents purchased a prune and pear orchard in Alexander Valley in 1967. It had 5 acres of Zinfandel vines on it, but it was mainly an orchard. And we took the trees out and planted to Chardonnay, Cabernet, and a couple other varietals. So our childhood in Alexander Valley was mainly on weekends when we would come up and work with our friends, driving tractors, pulling big rocks out of the vineyards, fun stuff like that. And fast forward to 1982, when Park oversaw the building of our winery, 81, 82, and we entered the market in 1984.
Okay. But so, what compelled your parents to
so many questions.
Yeah, I know. So, I mean, the quick question is, you're living in Berkeley, what compels them to buy something up in Alexander Valley?
Our father was from the Midwest, and I think people in between the coasts are very tied to the land in a slightly different way than people on the coasts. He was also in charge of communications and public information at UC Berkeley during the 1960s.
Okay.
It was a busy time.
Yeah, nothing going on.
It was really sleepy. And I think for him in particular, it was the light at the end of the tunnel. He figured he could make it through the free speech movement, Students for Democratic Society, Mario Savio, as long as retirement looked peaceful. Though, of course, he didn't truly retire. Until the end of his life, he was always active. But what compelled them to buy the land was actually moving to a pretty idyllic lifestyle in a rural agricultural setting, which resonated for both of them.
Were they interested in growing grapes, or was that just kind of what made sense at the time?
Well, growing grapes is pretty exciting in California. It's why we're all here in Sonoma County having a lot of fun, and I think it was attractive. And he leaned hard on neighbors for advice, and the county farm advisor, and UC Davis. And what would you add?
Well, I would mention that Mom and Dad started making homemade wine 2 years prior to buying the property.
Oh, okay.
Which probably planted the seed slightly. Our neighbor two doors away was a guy whose name may ring a bell, Davis Bynum.
Sure.
And he taught our parents and the parents between the Bynums and us how to make wine. And we made wine with our neighbors or I should say Mom and Dad did until maybe 1981, the year before we built the winery.
Because this is such an interesting time in Berkeley, to your point. I mean, you mentioned the free speech movement and everything that was happening on the campus, but around the campus, you've got Alice Waters, you've got Kermit Lynch, you've got things like on the food and wine scene really kind of bubbling up.
Yeah, and Mom and her sister, our aunt, taught French cooking for several years, and food has always been very important to our family, and food and wine just go hand in hand. So
yeah, absolutely. So they were in the right place to sort of like be, you know, inspired, hopefully, and then their Midwest roots like called them to actually come own something and farm it themselves.
And find out if agriculture is still as idyllic as he thought.
Was it?
There's a lot of hard work involved.
Yes,
I'm not sure he knew that ahead of time, but he learned quickly.
Did they grow up on farms in the Midwest? Did your parents meet back there,
out here?
What?
They both lived in urban settings. Dad in St. Louis, though he spent some time in the Depression. His family moved from Missouri to Imperial County. And our grandfather worked for John Deere selling equipment. My mom had a much more urban setting, grew up in Berkeley. But they both took to life in Alexander Valley very quickly and loved being a part of that community.
So, yeah, no, I'm wondering about, we always wonder, that time period, like, who was the community? Like, who were some of the people that your parents interacted with, or who helped mentor you, or who were kind of around at that time? Because it's early days for Sonoma County.
Well, Robert Young was big in was a huge mentor for Dad in particular. Total consummate gentleman. Mm-hmm. Shared all his knowledge. In fact, he recommended our first vineyard manager, which was a nephew of his, Dan Rotlisberger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who's on my board today.
Daniel or Dan?
Oh, yeah. Well, I assume young Dan, so that would Dan. Be the...
His grandfather.
Yeah, yeah. So his grandfather.
Wow. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because we've had Dan on sharing early stories of farming with his grandfather.
Yeah. Well, this is even a little earlier than that.
Wow. Yeah. So I want to know, when you were coming out from Berkeley, I assume on weekends, did it feel like work, or were you just playing? Was this a big playground when it first started for the two of you?
Some of both.
Okay.
we each got to invite a friend, we had what we called rock concerts. We would drive through the vineyard down the rows with a tractor with a front bin on it, and our job was to pick up rocks and throw it in the bin that were bigger than our two hands. And there was a rotation. Everybody picked up rocks except for one kid who got to drive. And when he got to the end of the row, he stepped out. Someone else stepped in. So it was like, you know, we had a ready supply of lots of friends because people got to drive a tractor. You know, and have fun doing that. It's where we all learned how to drive cars out on the fields. Didn't matter if we hit a prune tree or a pear tree. And our friends got to drive, so it was, you know, it was also a simpler time. Mm-hmm. And the prospect of being in that kind of agricultural setting was very attractive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet. Was Healdsburg kind of the town that you would frequent when you came up here, or Cloverdale, or I mean, you know, they were very different.
It was definitely Healdsburg, but it was very different than it is now.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking. Is like,
and driving through Novato, you know, when 101 went through Novato and stopping at stoplights. So this was, you know, and there was an ice cream shop right off of 101 on the way south, where if we had been good, we were always bribed into good behavior by knowing that we were going to stop at Herbert Sherbert's.
Funny. Okay, I kind of love that.
I love Herbert that Sherbert. Too. Yeah. I sort of remember a time when there wasn't really a freeway from Berkeley up north either. I mean, you had to drive through Richmond and all the stoplights there too. So it must have taken a little bit of time to get from Berkeley to Alexander Valley in those days.
Well, funky old station wagons could drive fairly quickly.
That's true. So. With like a V8 engine or...
Yeah.
No seatbelts.
So I want to know, you mentioned your food was always a really important part of growing up. So was there always, even before the home winemaking, wine on the table? Was that something, do you remember, like, was there a time when you didn't or did start to have that experience?
Well, not for us, but for Mom and Dad. Yeah.
Okay. There was no watered down little glass?
No, we didn't do that.
Okay. Mm.
Next generation did that.
Yeah.
But
I got watered down coffee with a lot of cream on it when I was a kid growing up. That was our version in the Midwest. We didn't have wine either.
Yeah.
But not even for the parents at that point. But yeah, watered down coffee, not good.
Doesn't sound great.
But it had a lot of sugar and milk in it, so that's basically what I was drinking.
Was it like Senka to begin with, which is already watered down coffee?
I think at that point we were doing like full on Folgers.
Oh,
so,
nice.
I mean, it was being brewed. So yeah, we were fancy. Very, very
good
fancy.
Stuff.
You know?
Okay. All right. So at some point, Park, you in particular seem to have taken to wine making, kind of the production side. When did that happen?
I guess near the end of high school. I enjoyed spending some time up on the ranch in summers when the vineyard manager would go on vacation, and I keep an eye on things. And I enjoyed science and math in high school, and so when it came time to put down something on the college application, I put down winemaking, figuring that'd be something else in 4 or 5 years. But I went to Davis and took a year off between my junior and senior year, worked a harvest at Louis Martini with Mike Martini, who was a classmate at Davis at that point, and then spent 6 months traveling around Europe doing some research, also known as drinking a lot of wine.
Yes, yes.
And that time really impacted kind of my view of what a good winemaking style is. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, influenced the style of our wines ever since then.
Had your parents had ambitions of having a winery, or was that really your generation that decided to start a brand and use your grapes for your own wines?
Well, I think they started the subliminal messages when we were in high school. But by the time I was graduating from Davis, we had planned to build a winery. I worked a couple of years after graduating from Davis before we started building the winery. But Mom and Dad actually came up and audited small winery design class with me that Roger Bolton taught.
Oh, wow.
Which
okay.
was fun for us.
What was the main thing you learned from that class?
Oh, it was, you know, about laying out the footprint of the winery, what kind of equipment you'd need, how you're going to make wine, which has bearing on, you know, what kind of tanks you're going to get, what size, so on and so forth.
Okay, logistics, yeah. So during this time, Scott, what are you doing?
Well, I was in college, mm-hmm. and when I graduated from college, on the East Coast, I came back to California and did some work in hospitality, mm-hmm. Food service, and then there was this funny time when distributors would be really interested in who the new winery was. Or the new wineries that were opening that year, and distributors would woo them. Those wineries would sign up with them. A couple of years later, there'd be a new shiny object, and the distributors would lose interest in those now no longer new wineries. And those wineries had a really hard time getting the distributors to sell their product. Before we started selling wine, there were a couple of notable situations that Mom and Dad were aware of where people really felt held hostage. Mm-hmm. Small new wineries held hostage. So we made a decision that we wanted to control how we were represented, and we made a conscious decision to sell directly to people at home. At that time in California, there were only two wineries that sold exclusively direct, Windsor Vineyards and Stony Hill, which was run by Fred and Eleanor McCray. And with the idea that we were going to sell direct, I went to work for a startup in San Francisco, a startup catalog company, the Sharper Image, right. which was 100% catalog at the time that I worked there. And the whole intention was to sort of learn direct sales. Hmm. And that was in the early 80s. I left and started working for the winery in 84. At the beginning of the year, with the intention of setting up our sales effort. The height of naivete was that we thought, oh, we'll just, it'll take 3 to 6 months to set it up, and then I'll go find another job, thinking that it would be effortless. But anyone in wine sales knows that's not what it is.
Okay, we're gonna take a quick break. We'll come right back on with Park and Scott Hafner. Back on the good stuff with our guests today, Park Hafner and Scott Hafner, second generation of Hafner Vineyard. And so, Scott, you were telling us a little bit about you're learning the sales, essentially.
Yeah, and direct sales, you know, how to move product from a distance. And, you know, at the Sharper Image, it was an issue of volume. And, you know, it was a time there were all these exciting toys and white sound machines and sensory deprivation yeah. tanks and ionics, you know, ionizers and things like that. But it was the mechanism, sort of the process of selling, using consumer mail order lists to acquire new names, recency, how often, sales volumes. And then also, I didn't work on the logistical side, but, you know, I was young and curious, so I also learned a lot about distribution and packing and shipping and UPS and all those details, which came into play when we entered the marketplace in 1984.
And, okay, so did you, I mean, while you were at Sharper Image, were you already seeing how you could apply your skills to the wine industry, or was it... like, were you still trying to figure that all out?
No, I mean, you know, part of the method to the madness is that we as a family would talk about things. You know, in the dinner table conversation, even after we moved and established our own families, you know, it's, we are a family that has really enjoyed working together, and people are curious, you know, so the dinner table conversation was always about what'd you learn and how is someone doing this and how is someone else doing that. And I was the one that was working at the Sharper Image, but everybody had questions. You know, Park was the one that was making wine, but everybody had questions. Dad had overseen the growing of grapes before we got involved. You know, so it was always a very dynamic, curious, fun, fascinating, collaborative conversation. So it wasn't like being assigned to something and sent off on your own. Yeah. It was definitely a team effort, and that team effort exists till today. Thankfully, bringing in the third generation.
Yeah. Hmm. So I want to know, when you went from 5 acres of Zinfandel to Cabernet, Chardonnay, how did that turn, and the pears and the
I couldn't fruits. Tell you the exact year, but we started taking out orchards pretty quickly and slowly replanting to, or slowly, putting in grapes.
And did you know it was Cabernet and Chardonnay because of what was around, the neighbors? You mentioned Robert Young. And
yeah, well, we kind of... our business had to be a profitable business because there wasn't money coming in from another source, which isn't always the case in the wine industry. Mm-hmm. So we kind of looked at, well, what is the most valuable red variety out there? Cabernet at the time. How about the most valuable white variety? Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. We put in some Gewürztraminer. We had some Riesling. There was some Zinfandel when Mom and Dad bought the property.
Yeah.
So we've had all those. We even grew some Pinot for a while, but over 45 years, we've learned what grows well and what sells well from Alexander Valley. And so we've kind of went on it down to Cabernet, Malbec, Petit Verdot, and Chardonnay now.
Yeah, because that was kind of during the transition where we really went from bulk sort of grapes, wine, into sort of more premium, looking at site-specific, sort of interesting. So you were kind of right there as that was all transitioning.
Yeah, we never were really part of the bulk wine business.
The reds or the whites in different bins and hauled in.
Oh, Yes, exactly. Very different times.
Go ahead. I was just saying, did you ever sell grapes, or have you always used your fruit?
We still continue to sell about half the grapes we grow, depending upon the year.
Right.
And that's the case this year as well. We just kind of decided many years ago to focus, you know, to remain small, to make enough to keep our patrons happy, and then sell the rest.
Yeah.
And the economics of being both a grape grower and a winemaking operation are very helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're long in the vineyard, you know, then maybe you make a little more wine that year. You know, we have been able to be very light on our feet, and mainly to Park's credit, you know, and selling grapes, or doing a little bit of custom crush for someone. It's, you know, being flexible has paid off.
Yeah, because you started as both grower and winemaker, winery, but we've mm-hmm. seen kind of this transition in the last decade of a lot of our growers adding a small wine brand to their portfolio, I think, for some of those same efficiencies and benefits that you saw from the very beginning. Yeah. You know, the ability to have that spot for some of those grapes. Also, I think probably makes what I've heard, you know, the farmers feel a lot, I guess, smarter about the grape growing and the impacts on the wine when they're starting to actually see the wine all the way through that process too, and vice versa. So I don't know if there's kind of learnings that way.
I think it helps us to be able to sell grapes to say, here's some wine that we made it.
Right.
Made. Yeah. And, you know, I always come at grape growing from a winemaker's perspective, mm-hmm. which isn't always the case. And, you know, I was trained as a winemaker, so we're growing for quality before we grow for quantity.
Right.
And yeah. I think that's obvious. And I, you know, when I've got other winemakers out in the vineyard looking at grapes, we're talking the same language. Mm-hmm. And we want to do the same things. It's not like we're doing something special for them. We're doing the same thing already for us, whether it's green drop or, you know, limiting irrigation or mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah, mm. I like that.
So I'm curious, Park, with you know, your experience in tasting a lot of wine from Europe and working at Martini, did you kind of have a vision for what kind of wines you wanted to make under your own name?
Yeah, I think our philosophy has always been to make wines that go well with food and that age well, which is sort of the European mm-hmm. influence. And so for me, that means picking at a lower sugar and ending up with a slightly lower alcohol, higher acidity, you know, looking at balance as opposed to making the biggest wine you can. You know, for us, oak plays a back row seat to the varietal character. Mm-hmm. It should be there, should add some complexity, some richness in the mid palate, but we don't make wines that are come across as particularly oaky.
Right, right.
And that works well for us as well because of our parents' depression era values. That means we don't spend a lot of money on lots of new oak every
right.
year,
which right.
I just don't think that, personally, that's not the kind of wine I want to drink, and selfishly, we make the kind of wines we like to drink.
Right. Yeah, of course. And, I mean, did that make your wines sort of popular in restaurant settings? Have you had good success there?
We sell 95% of our wine direct to people at home. The other 5% we sell to just top restaurants in the state of California. And the wine has always been well received in restaurants, but it's a very intentionally small part of our business. We felt we wanted to establish relationships with individuals mm-hmm. And have them be interested in our wines. And the other piece about selling direct is it allowed us to offer a greater value than a lot of our peers do. Because by not selling through the distributor network, we were able to retain a larger margin. And as long as our increased sales costs were less than that margin, we were coming ahead and we were offering a great value, which, as Park said, was really important to sort of the family culture of thrift and financial stewardship and not taking oneself too seriously and adding another zero to the price of the wine.
Right. Okay, we have to take another quick break. Be back on the good stuff. Stuff with our guest Park Hafner, Scott Hafner, second generation Hafner Vineyard. So give us a little, you know, sense of how what wines you make, what can people get, sort of give us the lineup.
We make six different wines. Starting in 1982, Park began making Chardonnay and our Cabernet Sauvignon. And maybe talk a little bit about the Reserve Chardonnay and why you began making that.
Yeah, so the Maine Chardonnay is kind of a combination of French and California winemaking techniques. California, based on what I'd studied at Davis and worked for a couple of years in Napa Valley, and then my wife and I got married in 81 and took a working honeymoon to France and worked in Burgundy in Meursault, which is kind of Chardonnay central. And I came back from that internship thinking it would be fun to kind of emulate or see what would become of our wines if we followed some of their techniques. So the Reserve Chardonnay is based on that time, barrel fermented, full malolactic. But again, the focus is on balance, and so not buttery.
Right, not too much oak.
But still, good acidity, good balance, lower alcohol, just like they were making in Meursault at Domaine des Comtes Lafond.
Okay, and then you have some other new releases, I understand.
And then in the late 90s, planted Petit Verdot and Malbec to blend with the Cabernet, which was successful. And Park's curiosity and our patrons' interest intersected, and we began making a second red wine, which is a Malbec-based blend, primarily Malbec, with Cabernet and Petit Verdot also. Called Next Red, and which is a more fruit-forward, slightly richer than the Cabernet, which is more austere and elegant. And then, when did you begin making rosé?
We began making rosé in 2011, and that was because of the fact that we've been growing Malbec, and Malbec is rather large berried variety. We'd been draining off juice every year to kind of intensify the flavor of the Malbec, and after doing that for a few years and going to Provence as a family, we decided to make a little bit for family and employees, and after doing that every other year for a couple of years, we decided, why not try making a little bit of rosé? So it's always been a rosé of Malbec, and started off small and grew pretty quickly.
That was early.
That's so rosé do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's made in the Provençal style, fairly light, crisp, dry. Seems to be a crowd pleaser now.
Yeah, and rosé, you know, a number of years ago used to be sort of felt like a seasonal wine. It was just for summer. But with Thanksgiving coming up, rosé is one of our family's favorites around Thanksgiving. And then to satisfy Park's significant appetite for sparkling wine, we began making sparkling wine.
We joined Park in that significant appetite for sparkling wine.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And began making Blanc de Blanc in 2020.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And what? How would you describe the Blanc de Blanc?
So obviously, Blanc de Blanc means sparkling wine made by white wine, with white grapes. In this case, Chardonnay. And we're using kind of traditional champagne techniques. A good friend of ours who's made sparkling wine for 40 plus years on three different continents, including time in Champagne, said, sure, if you want to make some sparkling wine, I'll work with you. So we hand pick it at night in small lug boxes that hold about 30 pounds, load it direct to press. Some of it's fermented in stainless steel, some is in barrels, and then it's tirage bottled on site and aged for a little over 2 years before it's riddled and disgorged.
So all right. I would describe that then as delicious.
Yes.
Is what I'm
absolutely
excited to try right now. You just released.
We just released our 2022. Perfect timing for the holidays. Yeah. And the thing that's fascinating, you know, we were selling five different varietals when we began making the Blanc de Blanc. And people, you know, Chardonnay, Cabernet, different varieties. Everybody was very focused on the variety, on the varietal, and serious, you know, and about wine and so forth. And then when we started selling Blanc de Blanc, all of a sudden, we were selling fun.
Yes, that's right.
And people were not talking as much about, oh, the Chardonnay pairs really well with this and the Cabernet pairs well with that. People were talking about, oh, the Blanc de Blanc is going to be wonderful for this christening that we're doing or for this anniversary party, you know.
Tuesday night
and Wednesday night and Thursday night.
Come on, everybody.
Yeah. So we make a small amount of the Blanc de Blanc and are happy that it was just released and is selling briskly.
All right. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us today on The Good Stuff.
Our pleasure.
Things up on today's Good Stuff with Hafner's.
I know, there was so much more to get into. I mean, they're actually the third generation is now back working at Hafner. I don't know on Scott's side, but I know on Park's side, his daughters are back working. One recently back from France. So I think that tradition continues, which is always exciting to have the next generation on the ranch.
Absolutely. So we do have some details on how you can visit. They do not have a sort of formal tasting room, but on the first and third Friday of every month at 2 p.m., it's very specific.
I like it.
People are welcome.
Was there a better time to try wine and take a tour than 2 p.m.?
No. Okay. I just like that they're very precise.
Yeah, I like that too.
So yeah, you can go for a tour and tasting led by a family member, and they share kind of what's going on in the vineyard, in the winery. They taste new and older wines in the cave. So sounds like a very cool experience. But you basically have to email directly, scott@hafnervineyard.com, or call 707-433-4606, and why not? Go do it.
I would do that just to go tour the property.
Yep.
I think that's amazing. I love those kind of immersive experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it'd be a great visit and hear some good stories and see where they used to have rock concerts and all
And especially since there's not a lot of opportunities to try their wines outside of visiting them.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very limited, 5% kind of sold outside of direct to consumer. So go visit.
So go. Hafner Vineyard. Scott@hafnervineyard.com.
And we did have permission to give out his personal email address, so there you go. Just for the record.
Right. Yeah.
Everyone's like, what?
Well, yeah. We don't have permission to give out, you know, home addresses.
I was going to say, that's totally where I went. I was just about to announce where you live.
Go meet
Kevin the squirrel.
Nope. Please don't. Unless you hit him on the way in. You can, you know, I mean, nicely.
Nicely. Yes.
Take him away.
Oh, my gosh. So Tuesday night wine. What are you going to do?
So I was intrigued kind of by their next red. I like that they sort of, you know, just get a little inventive there. And so I think the current vintage 2021, so Hafner 2021, next red, Alexander Valley.
I bet you have no idea what I'm going to drink on Tuesday night. No idea.
I can only wonder.
Ding, 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 ding. Can I give any foreshadowing? Well, I'm going to have to see if I can get a bottle of the Blanc de Blanc that was just released. I think you said it was the 22.
I think you might have to go on the first or third Thursday or Friday.
I might have to make up an excuse to have a private appointment so I can get it sooner.
Just show up on official business.
Or maybe I guess it's
here to talk about
Tuesday.
Grapes.
I'm going to have to go on a Tuesday and see how that works. and then drink it that night because I'm very impatient.
Yeah. Well, or you could sneak in on one of the Fridays.
I might do that too. Okay, fine. Okay. Definitely go visit the first and third Friday of each month at 2 p.m. Reach out to scott@hafnervineyard.com if you would like to reserve a spot.
And you mentioned that it's the third generation is already involved as well, which we didn't have time to get into, but always a good sign.
Always a good sign. Yes. So a lot more to come from Hafner Vineyard.
Okay. Well, that was fun.
I know. Are you going to come over and have bubbles with me on Tuesday?
As long as you have orange slices.
We do. Well, you might have to get another bag because I plan to consume the rest of this after the show.
Okay, sounds good. From Sonoma County to wherever you are, remember to drink the good stuff.
Cheers to that. Good times.